I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Andrew, I've got a theory that I want to put to you in this episode of the podcast. And that theory goes something like, you probably don't ever need to spend more than £10,000 or so to get a tasty car. What do you reckon?
I think... What I'm battling with here is my definition of the word need, because sure. You know, to me, need and tasty car don't necessarily sit in the same sentence at all. But I think if what you're saying is that 10 grand is what you need, I think what 10 grand buys you, as I suspect we will be able to illustrate over the course of the next hour or so, is that the scope that 10 grand allows you to explore is so wide, everything from, you know, huge saloons to tiny sports cars, that it is unlikely that within that field you ain't going to find anything that floats your boat. So, you know, so from that point of view, absolutely. Because I think that if the budget is much smaller than that, particularly if it was 5 grand, there would just be certain entire genres of car that would be off limits to you. And clearly, even at 10 grand, you know, there aren't going to be any Ferraris, Lamborghinis or Aston Martins on this list. But, you know, there will be at least one of almost anything that you could want to go and buy, which you can go and buy today for 10 grand. So, that's what I think. I suspect over the next hour I may be made to look rather foolish, but we will see.
Yeah, we will see. Quite right. And as you've sort of alluded to, we're being relatively sensible, or at least... We say you can buy a tasty car, any tasty car that you want, within reason, okay? So we're not looking for supercars. We're not looking for, you know, new luxury cars. Obviously, you can't pick those up for 10 grand. But you've written a list of cars, and I've added to it myself. And just, I won't tell you what they are now, but just scrolling through the list, we've got M cars, we've got a couple of V12s, we've got Japanese sports cars, we've got hot hatches, we've got coupes. There's a very... very high-end luxury car in there. We've got some...
you know what that one is. Exceptionally brave.
Yes. We've got some very cool Alfa Romeos. Some really cool Japanese stuff. There's some really intriguing tackle at about 10 grand. I think the other thing that we have to acknowledge is that some of these cars, they will cost much more than a sort of £10,000 car budget to keep going. So just because the car costs 10 grand, it doesn't mean you're going to run it for... Ford Focus money, you know. I think that sort of has to be addressed up front.
I think the other thing to say, I think the other thing about the 10 grand price point is it does remove a lot of cars that you might otherwise consider, not because necessarily they're great to drive or whatever, but, you know, maybe because they've just got a great badge on the bonnet. And, you know, I was struck by what you're talking about, hot hatches and Japanese sports cars and this way. And these are, you know, really honest cars that are built, but that are bought by enthusiasts for, you know, just because, you know, they're great to drive, because no one's ever going to, you know, think you're some kind of superhero because you turn up outside the house in one. It's, you know, these are cars for people like us, I guess, you know, for people who just love to drive and really couldn't give two hoots about, you know, what they think it might say about them. And I quite like that. I find that refreshing. And I think that actually coming in at 10 grand, it just removes those options. And sometimes, you know, there is some comfort in that necessity. So, no, I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah, quite right. Actually, it's very sensible to point that out. This podcast is not about making you look very cool or like you've got a shed load of money for £10,000. And actually, looking through the list, if that's what you're expecting, you're going to be disappointed because, well, we'll get into that. Okay, so I caveated this whole £10,000 thing by saying that some of these cars are going to cost a substantial amount of money to keep on the road. And the first car on your list, Andrew, I think is maybe the prime example of that.
Well, how do you think we ought to sort of have a bravery index? Do you think we ought to sort of associate a number between, you know, one, which is where, yeah, you'd be kind of all right, you'd be unlucky to get a big bill, to 10, which is you kind of, you know, you got to be kidding. You know, one light on the dashboard and you throw it away.
Yeah, I was going to say a star system, but that's sort of inverse to what we want. So maybe a warning light system or a skull and crossbones, maybe.
Yeah, a skull and crossbones, that'll do. Okay.
Okay. Right, so before you mention what the first car is, how many skulls and crossbones are you awarding?
I don't even know what this car is. See, the thing is, Dan, you've seen my list, but I haven't seen yours, which is really very,
well, this is
very...
your list.
Okay, this is my... Okay, so I'm not... Okay, so how many skull and crossbones on this one? Yeah, quite a few. I'm going to give it probably, yeah, 8/9 skulls and crossbones for this one.
Okay.
Because we are talking about...
the E60 BMW M5.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So you can pick these up for about 10K, can you?
Well, I found one, certainly, on piston heads.
And it had an engine.
And the other thing I would say about our 10 grand price point is that it's a bit sort of notional insofar as, you know, some of these cars might be advertised for 11, but bearing in mind there'll be others elsewhere which you may not have looked at, and with a bit of haggling, we think that these are cars, examples of which you will be able to find for that kind of money. And if you buy a 10 grand E60 5-litre V10 BMW M5, good luck to you. I mean, we know about these cars, and we know that their engines are not perhaps the most reliable things ever to be slotted under the bonnet of a car with a propeller on its nose. But, I mean, you know, while it lasts, wow. The reason I stuck this in here was that I actually, because I'm not as up to speed with that kind of generation of M car in terms of their current values as I should be. So I just sort of went sort of surfing around piston heads, looking actually for E39s, and you can't get them. E39s, you know, the earlier 5-litre V8 cars, which we all love, they've kind of gone away now, and you're going to be paying 15 plus for one of those. And it tells you all you need to know about the E60, that the sort of later, more powerful V10 one is actually quite a lot cheaper.
Yeah, and a lot cheaper, perhaps because of the running costs, the reliability issues. Yeah,
exactly.
Lots of people listening to this will be familiar with a photographer, probably through Twitter or Instagram, called Mark Riccioni, who's got a small fleet of very, very interesting cars. And until recently, he had an E60 M5 touring, his was, because it went up in flames.
Technically an E61.
Well, quite right.
Sorry.
You pedant. Well, yes. You may have missed the point. But his car went up in flames. It was constantly on the back of a flatbed, his car. I think it had a warranty. And so every time it went wrong, which seemed quite often... Sitners would send round a flatbed and pick it up, and it seemed to happen endlessly until one day, I actually don't know quite what happened to the car, but he posted some pictures of it.
He did tell me, and I forgot. It basically just self-immolated, didn't it? And that was the end of that.
Wow. So
he was remarkably phlegmatic about it. Well, I mean, anybody who knows Mark will know that he is a fantastically laid-back bloke. But I mean, he was just sort of like, yeah, well, it's always going to happen, wasn't it? And, you know, move on.
So we've got off to a really good start here, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, really, yeah, really recommend you all go out and spend 10 grand on an E60.
I think we've mentioned this car before, perhaps in the M podcast that we did. But where do you rank the E60 or E61 in terms of all the different M5s over the years? It's interesting.
Not that highly, if I'm honest with you. Because obviously we now know that there are reliability issues. But even at the time, it was highly amusing. I mean, the engine was fabulous, but it had no mid-range torque, which in a big saloon is not what you want. The gearbox was really pretty unpleasant. I just think an E39 is a far better car with that glorious V8. And obviously, you know, if you've got two 5-litre engines, one with 8 cylinders and one with 10, one with 400 horsepower, one with 500 horsepower, the one with, you know, the 400 horsepower V8 is going to be, you know, awash with mid-range torque by comparison. And that's what you drive these cars on. To me, I would put it behind the E34 and the E39, probably even the current car. Much better than the previous. I lose interest in BMW numbers once they're no longer prefixed by an E, I'm afraid. I just can't keep up with them all. A lovely idea in theory, in practice, not without problems.
I think that's fair. Okay, well, let's move on quickly. Otherwise, this podcast is going to run for 3 hours. We'll just work through your list, which means that we go to another M car. And we'll be brief on this because we have already declared the E46 M3 the best M car of all time.
Didn't you go M2 comp?
I can't remember.
Or have I dreamt that?
I think maybe you dreamt. I think we actually agreed on E46 M3, all things considered. And a few years ago, these were looking unbelievably good value. I think they were slipping down to sort of 7-8k. It looks to me now that prices have sort of hardened a little bit. You used to have your, not your pick of cars at 10k, but you could be a bit choosy. Now it looks like it's almost bottom of the barrel.
Yeah, not quite, but getting there. But I mean, I still think, I think they're going to be kind of like the sort of 205 GTIs of their era and of their genre. I think these are cars which, you know, everybody knows how good those cars are. Everybody knows that, you know, it's the best M3, certainly for the money, that you can go out and buy. And the other thing is that because there were quite a few of them, and because they're not that old, you know, you may take a bit of hunting because obviously a lot of them are being used and abused, but you can still get good cars. And I think, I think if you can get a decent car with a proven history and not crazy miles on the clock, and, you know, please nobody come back and say, you know, Frankel, you said this, you know, back in 2020 and it's cost me that. But, you know, I think that, you know, they are strong. They are, you know, they're reliable in the main. And I think they'll look after you. I think that's, you know... I mean, the thing is, no one should buy any of these cars. Frankly, I don't think anybody should ever buy any car for the purpose of making money out of it, and certainly not cars like this. These are cars to use and to enjoy. But at the same time, if you buy one thinking, well, you know, I'm not going to lose my shirt as long as I don't get a big bill, and I think the chance of getting a big bill with an E46 are lower than certainly an E60 but also some other cars on this list. And you can have it in the reassurance that, you know, it's not going to depreciate, and if anything, it might even go up slightly. And it's even possible that if you kept it for 5-10 years, you know, didn't do crazy miles in it, that at the end of it, you may have ended up effectively having had a free E46 because, you know, you'll get back what you spend on it over time.
It's a compelling thought, isn't it? And of course, as we all know, the one to have is a Barocca yellow cab with the SMG gearbox on 19s.
Yeah, took the words right out of my mouth, mate. Yeah.
So you'd have a coupe on 18s manual in a dark colour or silver or something?
Yeah, dark blue, dark grey. Yeah, something like that. Lovely. Really, really nice. Don't get me going.
You've never owned a Porsche 944, have you?
I've owned a 968. It's quite close.
Yeah, it's only 24 numbers out. But so
and I crashed my father's 944. Does that count?
Yeah, that does count. I think that does count.
Yeah, so I was. We had a little drive where I grew up because we lived in the countryside, and he had a 944, and I was 16. And so I used to drive it down the drive without him knowing as fast as I possibly could, but there was a little kink in the drive which I always used to try to take flat.
How old are you?
16.
Oh, good.
But I tried to... Or maybe I was 17. I might have been 17 or 18. But anyway, I certainly wasn't allowed to drive it. Anyway, I tried to take this kink flat, which was fine, which I managed. But I didn't I didn't count on the postman coming the other way in his Morris Marina van. Yes. The good news was there was no damage to the Porsche at all. There literally wasn't a mark on it. And I think the postman was really, really understanding. I think he probably wanted a new Morris Marina van. But he just said, don't worry about it. And so I got away with it. But anyway, we're not here to talk about... Porsches I've crashed, but no, I had a 968 until quite recently. And I obviously, you know, because I'm so bloody old, I was testing 944s in period when they came out, and they're just cracking cars. The one to get, which you can't get for 10 grand, is a 3 litre normally aspirated S2. They are the 944s, better than the turbo, slightly less powerful, but much nicer engines. But even if you just get a standard 944, particularly if it's a series one car, particularly if it's a 2.7. Which just has more torque than the 2.5. They're just lovely things. They're beautifully balanced. I think they're great to look at. I love the look of those cars. Much better looking than the 968. Just proper driver's cars. And it's.
And you know, I suspect it's the sort of car that you can learn a lot about driving in, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. Because they're not quick. They're not fast. I mean, you know, they probably... In their day, they were probably a bit quicker than a 1.9 TFSI GTI, but not much. Cross country, I don't think there'd be a damn thing in it. But as you say, just, you know, lovely, you know, quite slow, but very mechanical manual gearbox, gearbox at one end, engine at the other, proper balance, lovely, you know, big, torquey 2.5 litre or 2.7 litre four cylinder donkey. Not much not to like about those. And again, you know, you can get builds with them, but I mean, they're pretty good. Love to have one of those.
Do they have LSDs in them?
No, they didn't. Don't forget, I mean, a 968 Club Sport didn't have an LSD in it, unless you got the crazy whatever the code number option is, and then none of those cars
MO30 or something.
Exactly, yeah. So no, none of them did. But you know, then again, if you've got a gearbox shifting over your rear wheels, you don't really need one, because you know, you've got the traction, and you know, as we all know, you know, if you put an LSD in a car, one of the things it does, it makes it understeer. So you know, if you don't need it, and you know, with 160 horsepower, I think they had, and a transaxle. You know, the car had the grip, the car had the traction it needed, and LSD wasn't required.
But would you have one of those, or for similar money, a 2.7 litre 987-era Porsche Cayman?
As a recreation, I'd probably have the 944, but I completely understand why somebody else would want the Cayman. I completely respect that. It's quite a difficult thing to decide. But, I mean, a 944, I guess because it's so much older... to me is a much more sort of recreational pub type car these days, even though that's not at all what they were designed for. Whereas if I think of, even a very early Cayman, I think of them as being modern cars, which should be. And to me, they're not quite, I guess also because those early Caymans were so good, they're not yet sufficiently distanced from the here and now to have sort of acquired that, you know, that quaint charm. So, you know, if someone was looking, if somebody wanted a Porsche to use every day, then Cayman every day of the week, over any other Porsche, frankly. For the money, I think they are just, I mean, you know, you can get Boxsters for a lot less, even of the same sort of era, because there are more of them, and the market doesn't cherish them in the same way that they do that generation of Cayman these days. I just have a Cayman.
They're gorgeous to drive. Not fast with the 2.7. It's only got 5-speed box, isn't it? But the gear shift is gorgeous. Wonderful steering. Lovely pedals. You know, the pedals perfectly match to the other controls. It's just a honey. It's a real pleasure to drive that car.
Yeah, it's not too tied down on its springs. You're so right about the steering. And you know, I can remember you know, going on the launch of that, and it just seemed to. I mean, glide suggests some element of sort of float or lack of control. I don't really mean that, but it was just so effortless. It was so easy to carry speed in. You just never had to slow down for anything. Love those cars. When are we going to have one from your list? Because, I mean, I don't know, as I said earlier, I don't know what's on your list, and I'm intrigued.
Well, we'll jump onto my list momentarily, but first, okay. I just want to sit back and hear you make the case for car number 5 and car number 7.
Oh, hang on.
In brackets you put brave, and then then against number seven, even braver. So, well, can you construct a coherent case for these cars, or are they just both madness?
I think they're both madness, but that doesn't mean I can't construct a coherent case for them. You know, just because, well, you know, just because, you know, and I'm one of these people, just because, you know, you choose to only, like, you have a 10 grand limit on these things, it doesn't mean that they're going to be your only recreational car. You know, I've got a few bits of unimportant rubbish in my shed. And, you know, and there will be people, and I'm not one of these people, but then nevertheless may be people who can actually genuinely afford to run one of these things. And just thinks it's funny and likes the idea of having them around. And who knows, you know, they may be okay. So the cars we're talking about, so the first car we're talking about is, I found a Bentley Turbo, a 1986 Bentley Turbo, which had done 100,000+ miles. And
nothing.
Yeah, nothing. Well, actually, for those engines, it really isn't. It's all the other stuff you've got to worry about. You know, it's the sort of, I can't remember who did the electronics on it, but it sure as hell wasn't Bosch. I love those cars. Again, I'm so bloody old. I mean, okay, so I came in right at the end of that era. They were sort of, you know, quite posh long wheelbase turbo RTs at the time I started. But, you know, to me, they are, you know, if you like Bentleys, and if you, in your mind's eye, if you sum up what you think a Bentley should be, you think of a sort of a, you know, big barge groaning under the weight of its own, you know, wood and leather and metal and everything else. And you, and if you like that sort of thing, and I know it's not much to drive, you know, around a corner or anything else, but if you just like being sort of swept along in the majesty and the occasion of it all, I just really, really like those things. And I, you know, I don't really want to, you know, justify it any more than that. But obviously, you'd need to be very realistic about the cost of it. That said, you know, I do know someone who's, okay, it's not a Turbo R, but it's an Arnage, and he tools around in that. He uses it as a daily driver, leaves it out on the street, and he claims it's really good. He claims he just doesn't have any problems with it. So, you know, I think, like with all these things, there's so much luck of the draw about it, isn't there?
That was pretty convincing, I have to say. That you did make a good case for that.
Thank you.
You also sold the image and the sort of lifestyle quite well.
Well, there you go. That's what I'm here for. The invoice is in the post. The second car is cut from a very similar cloth, and that is a V12 XJS. Now, you can find any number of XJSs for less than 10 grand, but they've all got that rather gravelly 3.6-litre straight-six motor in it, which really, you know, didn't belong, I would say probably didn't belong under the bonnet of any Jaguar, let alone, you know, a 2+2 Jaguar coupe like the XJS. But you can just about get a V12. And yeah, it'll be really, really leggy. And it'll probably be leaking oil. And it may well be a bloody nightmare. But the thing is, I mean, the only reason I stuck it on there actually is, he doesn't have it anymore, but there's another mate of mine, Richard Bremner, who will be known to many people listening to this, who had a V12 XJS until quite recently. And it was, to be fair, a very nice V12 XJS, and it would certainly have cost an awful lot more than £10,000. But I just, you know, having not really thought about XJSs at all for, you know, however long it's been, 25 years or more since they've gone out of production, he turned up in it at something we were doing, and it was just lovely. It was just lovely. And I think it's grown into its looks, particularly the pre-facelift cars. And that engine, geez, it's such a top motor. And, you know, I just rejoice in the fact that, you know, even if it's not a particularly great idea, I just love the fact that you can, if you're stupid enough or brave enough, then it is still possible to go and buy a V12 2+2 Jaguar Coupe for, you know, the price of, well, I mean, what new car can you buy for 10 grand? You know, a Skoda Citigo or something like that. I just love the fact you can do it.
We've forgotten to award Skull and Crossbones to the last few cars that we've been talking about. So I think we need to put that right with the Bentley and the Jaguar. Oh, does it? It doesn't go beyond 10, does it? This system we've got.
No, but I don't think it needs to. I don't think it needs to. I would go. Yeah, they're both tens, aren't they? Because they're both a bit, because they do come into the category where, you know, something can happen, and that's kind of the end of the car, isn't it? Or if you know, actually, with, you know, with something like the Jaguar, what's going to happen is you are going to buy, you know, I think the greatest risk is clearly you could have some kind of terrible hydraulic problem or something like that. But I think the greatest risk is you buy a car which has been superficially tarted up, and then, you know, come MOT time, you suddenly discover that, you know, something's been gnawing holes in its underside, and the car is a sort of technical write-off. So, yeah, they'll both be tens. But, you know, okay, so let's look at, you know, the E46 M3. I'd give, what, a 2 or a 3 for that?
Yeah.
944, a 5 maybe.
Yeah.
987 Cayman, I mean, well, what do you think? Another 2 or a 3?
They do score their bores, don't they? But that, I think that's more the bigger 3.4 litre engine. There are certain things, certain bits and pieces that you need to be aware of with the engines in those cars nonetheless. So I think that's probably a 3 or a 4.
Yeah.
It just needs a bit of research, that car. But it shouldn't pull your pants down. Right, should I give you one of mine then?
Oh, please.
Okay, the last two that you've suggested were fairly sort of pie in the sky, if you don't mind me saying. So I'm just going to bring it back down to reality slightly. Although BMW M135i's, they're not quite at 10 grand. I think they're at about 11 grand. So I'm sort of stretching our budget a little bit. But, you know, it won't be long before they are down at 10 grand, maybe 6 months.
It's interesting how you know, I think if we're honest, we could have populated this entire list with BMWs, couldn't we?
I think we could. It's a very good point.
But we've already done our M Cars podcast, so I was quite conscious not to to give into that. But yeah, you're right. Great car.
So I wanted to talk about this because I ran one for 6 months a couple of years ago. And over time, we modified it. I did it with Birds, the BMW sort of tuning and servicing company.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Yeah, and so I had a 2012 car. It was a 3-door in blue, a manual. And they start out as nice cars, you know.
And then you ruined it.
Well, no, and we made it much better, I think, actually. They do start out as nice cars. They've got that good sort of willing turbocharged inline six engine.
But it barely feels turbocharged. The thing about that engine, isn't it? It's a fantastically good installation.
Yeah, and it's just over 300 horsepower. It's a, you know, classic BMW. It's a really lovely balanced thing. But I do think those cars need a little bit of tuning work just to bring the best out of them. And the best upgrade that Birds offered on that car was its spring and damper kit. And it's a kit that they'd come up with themselves, you know, the settings are all their own. It has IBAC springs and Bilstein dampers, with all the valving and the dampers tuned to their own specifications. And those uprated springs and dampers, they just, without totally ruining the ride or actually ruining the ride at all, they just clamp the body down a little bit more so it's not quite so floaty over a sort of three-dimensional road. Just a little bit more control and precision. And it really makes a huge difference. We also, I think we might have tickled the brakes a little bit, and maybe there was some geometry work. I can't remember, but
they don't have diffs in them. They don't have LSDs in them, do they?
Well, exactly. We put a Quaife LSD in it.
There you go.
Which made a huge difference. Really made it a proper blast to drive. Actually, you could skid around in it really happily. It was great. And then we couldn't resist remapping it. I think maybe 420 horsepower or something, maybe 410. And it, you know, at the end it was a
they weren't worried about melting the gearbox with the level of torque that went with it.
They certainly didn't mention it to me, and I had no issues in the time I had it.
Sorry, I was just going to say, this is what happens when people think, oh, I could really do with a set of springs and dampers on their car. And so what happens is they get a set of springs and dampers on their car, and that makes the handling really, really good. But then you think to yourself, oh, God, if only we could give it the traction to go with its, you know, lateral grip, give it that longitudinal grip. So you put a slipper in the thing, and then, you know, the car's got amazing traction and the thing goes around corners really fast, but of course it now doesn't feel very powerful. So you basically just end up sort of chasing yourself around the car, don't you?
Yeah.
Until you end up with what sounds to me like a complete nutter. I wish I'd driven it. It sounds like a fabulous thing.
They've still got it, and it's a very interesting car. But, you know, we have to acknowledge that all those upgrades, they're probably, I don't know, £5,000 or something, maybe £4,000. So we've blown the budget by half, but, you know, you could I reckon a few months from now, maybe next year sometime, pick up an M135i for a tenner, and then over time upgrade it with a few bits and pieces. And by the end of it, you've got a really fun, very usable, comfortable, fast car. We drag raced it against a E92 M3, a coupe, and over a half mile distance, there was hardly anything in it, maybe a couple of car lengths. So it's, you know, a really quick thing.
And for the money. And then, if you think that cost you $5,000, and how easily it would be to, how easy it would be to drop $5,000 into the maintenance of almost anything else we've spoken about today. I hear what you say.
A relatively sensible proposition there. How about another one for me? Honda Integra Type R DC2, 90s one.
Teg Type R, yeah. Why didn't I put that on my list? You're absolutely right.
I think $10,000 will buy you a decent one. I think they're about 7 or 8.
And this is the ultimate sort of anti-snob car, isn't it?
It really is, yeah.
Because nobody even knows what it is when they see it, let alone, you know, it's the car where the badge really, really couldn't matter less. But anybody who does understand, who sees that, it just thinks sort of proper person passing, don't they? Because, you know, only someone who really got it, who really understood, you know, the legend of the Integra Type R, would recognise that car for what it was, which is, of course, you know, one of the most involving, entertaining front-wheel drive cars of any kind that's ever been built.
Mm. Yeah, that amazing 1.8 litre inline four, the normally aspirated engine that revs to, well, it sort of lights up at somewhere around 6,000 and then it just keeps
about
going
five and
beyond.
And a half, yeah.
Yeah, and then it keeps going beyond 8.
And it does that because it has a completely different set of cams that become activated. Literally, the cams just sort of slide down the shaft. And so it's not, you know, it's literally a switch, isn't it?
Yeah.
It just goes, ba 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 ba,
bap.
And it's fantastic. You're absolutely right.
It's brilliant. And so that power, not a great deal of power, but the delivery is incredible. It goes, of course, to the front wheels, as you said, via a really lovely, tight, mechanical locking diff, with wonderful steering, a properly sort of seminal gear shift, great seats. They're a pain in the ass on a long journey.
Because of the noise.
Yeah, just not what they're built for at all.
Yeah, they're really short gear. But also, you know, they've got double wishbones. I mean, like you know, like the Civics thing. Yeah, they've got double wishbone suspension at each corner. I mean, you know, how many hot hatchbacks have double wishbone suspension at all four corners? But you know, they did. It was, you know, in engineering terms, it was as pure and as proper as you could ever possibly imagine. And, you know, because nobody understands these cars or even knows what they are, they're just really cheap.
We're on a little bit of a Japanese sort of kick here, so I just want to give you one more. Toyota GT86. Again, like the M135i, they're not quite there, but they're very, very close. And that is a sort of much more modern car that you could happily use every day, and I think have some fun in. What do you reckon?
Well, have some fun. I've never done a journey in a GT86 without oversteering. Now, it has to be said, it occurred to me very early on in my GT86 driving career that I hadn't yet done a journey without oversteering. In all subsequent journeys, I have ensured that I oversteered because I don't want to break the record. But I had done quite a few journeys before it even occurred to me that that was what I... And, oh, you could have fun in a GT86. They're just brilliant things. They are. I mean, you know, back in the day when they were new, it won Autocar's best handling, or they call it Britain's best driver's car, didn't they? I think we were at Rockingham. No, we weren't. We were at Bedford. And there were all sorts, you know, the usual suspects, you know, Porsche, Ferraris, Lamborghinis. And this Toyota turned up on Prius tyres and dusted the lot of them. For all the things that, you know, we like about cars. Not because it was quick, because it wasn't. Not because it had lots of grip, because it didn't. But because it was just so damn good to drive. And ultimately, you don't need to justify in any other terms, do you?
No.
Somebody said to me the other day that you only know how fast you're going around a track when somebody, you know, hands you a stopwatch. But, you know how a car feels and how much fun it is to drive every time you turn the steering wheel. And that's what the GT86 does. And also, you know, pretty bulletproof, I would think. You know, built by Subaru. You know, very, very little to worry about there. So, I mean, I think in Skull and Crossbones terms, that's a sort of one or a two, isn't it?
Yeah, we need to award the same to the Integra. I actually don't know enough. I suspect they take a bit more maintenance because they're such exotic things.
I suspect sort they of deceptively. I suspect yeah. they rot as well. But if anybody out there knows differently and is now shouting at their radio or however they're listening to this, then my apologies. But my guess is that, you know, whatever it is, 20-odd-year-old Hondas like that, I suspect they're not that rot resistant anymore, but maybe they are. And I think, you know, and I think engines and gearboxes and that sort of thing will be fine because they were just so well built from the get go. So yeah, not bad.
Okay, so well, let's call it a four then, because we're not entirely sure. Someone will set us straight. Okay, let me give you one more of mine before we leap back to yours. Right, I need to choose one here. Okay, let's go with again. I'm sort of stretching the budget slightly, but you can just about get a B7 Audi RS4, the first V8 one. Do you fancy one of those?
Not really.
Interesting. You don't like
no.
them?
No, I do. I do. I'm surprised you can get them for that money.
Just. I write just with five U's.
Yeah. Actually, do you know what? No, I take that back. A mate of mine had one. Until very recently, and I think he did 230,000 miles in his.
Wow.
And he reckoned he'd done a clutch in it, and that was about it.
Crikey.
Magnificent engine, great looking car. I mean, as we all know, Audis have always been, you know, those sorts of Audis, they've always been terrific in a straight line and not been, you know, anything like as proficient when it comes to the tricky business of going around a corner. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's not on my list because I didn't think of it, because I just don't sort of think of those sorts of cars in these sorts of terms. But actually, because you weren't good enough to show me your list, just thought about it right now and being surprised that you can get one for that kind of money, then yeah, I think it just about... No, it does stack up.
Okay, well, based on what your mate has said, maybe it's a three or four. I mean, it's a big, powerful V8 engine. It's going to cost a few quid to keep it going, I would have thought. One other thing that I will say is that I've only driven the Audi Heritage fleet car, which is inevitably in very, very good condition. And an RS4 at 10 grand, it could be pretty baggy.
Yeah, and I think a lot of these things... I think the problem with an RS4 at 10 grand is it's just going to have question marks all over it, isn't it? And the thing about my mate's car was, you know, he did 230,000 miles. Well, it had done that, but I mean, I think he probably did, you know, 90%+ of those miles. So, you know, he knew where it had been. It had always been serviced properly. You know, he would have just looked after it properly. And if you just sort of take a giant leap and buy a car for 10 grand from, you know, Fred somewhere... you know, there are certain things you can do, can't you? You can check it's got a service history, but, you know, if it's got, you know, a full Audi service history, it's probably not going to cost 10 grand. I mean, I think it's quite a punt, but, you know, why not?
Okay, well, let's go back to your list. And can you make the case for number six, please, Andrew?
If I could remember what number six is, I certainly could. Yeah, okay. So we're back in Honda territory here. S2000. I mean, I make the case for that very easily. I mean, okay, they weren't, you know, this is where you get a big difference between looking at a car when it's new and revisiting it again as some kind of classic. And I remember this particularly with the BMW Z8, which I think we were all quite disappointed with when it was new. And then I drove one a couple of years ago. And I just thought, this thing's absolutely lovely. Okay, it's not a sports car, but it's a thing to sort of bimble about the countryside. Lovely interior, incredibly powerful, mellifluous V8. Wonderful. And the Honda S2000 is another one of those cars which would probably never have won a group test against a Boxster in its day. But now, if you think about, you know, the components, again, double wishbone suspension, that extraordinary engine, 2-litre, 4-cylinder engine, 237 horsepower, 9,000 revs.
9,000
revs. And yes, okay, you need to be doing, you know, you need to be two-thirds, you know, through that rev band before it started delivering proper power. But, you know, two-seat, open, convertible car which will perform like that for that kind of money, I mean... They're not actually, you know, in terms of handling, I think an Integra Type R is probably a much more rewarding car to drive. But, you know, for the power and for the fact that it's an open convertible and it is still pretty decent to drive, I think it's a great call for that kind of money. I really do.
I've driven a few, and I never got on with the seating position. I think the driver's seat, and perhaps the passenger seat as well, was always set just a bit too high, and that always bothered me. They had a reputation, Andrew. Were they spiky? Did you ever put one backwards through a hedge?
If I have, I've blanked it. I am mindful possible, of the fact that you asked me this question about something else once before. You said, have you ever crashed? You once asked me if I ever said, had I ever crashed a 911? I absolutely point blank said, no, I never have. And then about 2 minutes later, I realised that actually I had done a bit of damage to a GT2 RS and I was kind of mentally blanked it. But no, I really don't think that I have. I wouldn't have said they were spiky. And I drove them in the wet and in the dry. You couldn't play with them in the way that you could, muck about with, Boxsters and, other cars like that. But no. I mean, I think the thing was, it was kind of a car that was better driven within its limit anyway. It's not the sort of car that you'd necessarily want to go sort of prodding around on and over the limit. But no, spiky, when I think of the car, spiky is not a word that comes to mind, but maybe I was just lucky. Or an incredible driver, one of the two.
It's one of the two. okay, well, let's move on, because I want to hear you argue the case for a 2006 Mercedes-Benz S600, because it's got a 6-litre twin-turbo V12, more than 500 horsepower. I just love these 10, 15, 20-year-old luxury cars that have depreciated so heavily that they become unbelievably tempting. Even so, I'm surprised that one of these cars is available for 10 grand or so.
Yeah, well, I think you made the case for me. I mean, you said, I mean, there's no rocket science here. There's no sort of hidden secret about this. It's just an enormous amount of incredibly powerful V12 Mercedes barge for three-fifths of sod all money. I mean, it's no more than that. And again, obviously, because we've got two V12s, isn't it? And it's up there, and so it's not quite Bentley Jaguar territory in terms of just how scared you should be before taking on something like this. But I just love the idea that you can get this V12 twin turbo Mercedes for it's just funny for the same price as a Smart. It's just funny, and I think it's the sort of thing that if I were a very rich man, I would just kind of smoke around in one of those, because I wouldn't want something modern and ostentatious and plutocratic. I would just want something silly like that, which would be ostentatious and everything else, but everybody would know that it had cost me nothing at all to buy, and I would just find that more amusing. And actually, in terms of ride and refinement and everything else, unless there was something wrong with it, it would still be really, really good. It'd still be a really, really nice place to hang out. And that engine, as you will know, it's a pretty ancient engine these days, but my goodness, it gets the job done, doesn't it?
God. Yeah. Okay. Well, I reckon that's probably a 7 or 8 Skull and Crossbones.
Yeah, easy.
It's not quite up there with the Bentley and the XJS.
But it's knocking on the door, isn't it?
Okay. Right, I'm going to make the case actually for one of the cars on your list, number 12, which is the Mark V Golf GTI. And I have to mention it because I just think it's a fantastic car. 10 grand probably buys you a very, very decent one, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I was aware of the fact that, this list should have a few cars in it which are actually sensible buys for 10 grand, not just technical buys for 10 grand.
Yeah, okay. Well, I think probably half the money would get you a very sort of serviceable one. 10 grand is, you'll have your pick of them. But this was the car that sort of returned the Golf GTI nameplate to where it needed to be, really. And it was fun to drive. It had a fantastic seating position, and the seats were brilliant. Good engine, not sort of overly powerful. It's just it's around 200 horsepower, isn't it?
But strong. I mean, the car wasn't that heavy. And I always felt and I drove one not long ago, and I can remember both then and when they were new, they just felt more powerful than that. It felt to me like they were almost understating it. They always felt to me like they had a great deal of get up and go.
What I love about that car is its breadth of ability. It's actually really refined and comfortable to use every day. It looks good, it's practical, but it's genuinely good fun to drive as well. I think I've always lusted after one, actually. And I always said that I'd have one, but it just hasn't quite panned out that way, sadly. But yeah, I think that's such a strong candidate, even though you don't have to spend anything like 10 grand to get a good one.
But it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, so many cars on this list are, for either through the running costs or for their configuration, are, you know, quite slightly impractical, very definitely, obviously recreational cars. I think what's different about this Golf is it's quite the reverse, isn't it? If you're not using it every day, if you're not doing big miles in it, then, you know, I wouldn't recommend that you go and buy one. It's not a, you know, it's not a pride and joy to keep in the shed. It's a car just to sort of leave outside and use and abuse and get the absolute most out of all the time, because that's what it does best, isn't it? It's that breadth of ability you were talking about. And if you're doing anything else with it, you're probably not, you know, enjoying it to the full.
Yeah, exactly right. And it's interesting you make that point, because I think there are certain Renault Sports that you could put in the garage and only use from time to time and get a real kick out of them. But yeah, the Golf isn't one of those cars. Okay, TVR Chimera. I remember being, I don't know, 12 years old or something and seeing them. And I adored TVRs at that time. And I thought this was just the coolest thing. Never driven one, never sat in one. Are they good?
Yes. Well, I'd say a qualified yes. No, okay. They are good. For 10 grand, it would be amazing. Okay. So the Chimera is the most, it's not the best TVR of that era. That was the Griffith, but they are the most underrated. Because they were the sort of practical, sensible, long-distance one, and, you know, in all genres of cars, isn't it? Those are the cars relative to the rorty, snorty ones that get, you know, left in the shadows somewhat. But actually, you know, if you compare a 4-litre Chimera to a 4-litre Griffith, there's not an awful lot in it, both in terms of how fast they are or how much fun they are. But the Chimera is spacious and it's comfortable. I think if you drove one, I think you'd be surprised by how old it felt. They do have a very vintage feel. I mean, to me, they're more sort of more closely related to the sort of British sports cars of the 70s than they are to modern day machinery. But, you know, in that sort of certain sort of incompetence, there is certainly a charm. But the reason I stuck it on there is that I have a theory about TVRs. I mean, we all know that, you know, TVRs, you know, if you think TVR, the next thing you think of is cars parked at side of the road with pissed off bloke on his mobile ringing the AA. But actually, my theory is that although TVRs were not well built, now so much time has elapsed since they were built that everything that was going to fall off and will have fallen off by now and hopefully been put back by someone who knew what they're doing, i.e. not TVR. And I think that a modern TVR today that has been properly looked after will have gone, because the actual basics of it, you know, if you look at the structure, you look at the BorgWarner gearbox, you look at those old Rover V8 engines, I mean, that's all strong stuff. It was just all the bits that TVR did which weren't right. And they will have long since gone wrong and been corrected, or at least that's my theory. So, you know, I think they're quite sort of sleeper classics, those cars. And as long as you don't get in there and expect it to, you know, to drive like a modern car, then, you know, as a pure recreation, you know, they're not like Caterhams. They're not amazing things to, you know, balance on the, you know, right on the edge and feel incredible response on. They're just, you know, good old-fashioned British bruisers with a woofling V8 up front and, you know, taking on a 50-mile journey to the pub. Just lovely for that.
Mm. Yeah, I totally get the appeal of them, actually, without ever having driven one. You know, I really do understand it. But do we need to be slightly cautious and award it a five skull and crossbones or six?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, so the only other thing I would say about those cars is they're also, and another reason I like them is, I mean, I really, really like cars that are usable. And, you know, they had hard tops. You know, they didn't have, which were actually quite easy to put up. And then once they were up, the cars were quite, you know, reasonably well refined, and they had huge boots, and there were places you could put the hard top, so that, you know, they don't, it's not like, you know, like buying a Caterham, where, you know, you pay a price in practicality for the experience you're going to get. Okay, the TVR experience isn't anything like as rewarding as the Caterham one, but you can just do more stuff with it. Skull and Crossbones, yeah, five. It's a five, isn't it? It's a 5/6, isn't it? Because, you know, we are nevertheless still talking about quite an old car, which was quite inexactly built. But you know, when they were new, you'd have been putting an 8 or 9 against it. You know, that's when it was new, and we're not doing that now.
Okay, well, let's rattle off a few rapid fire style. And we'll just whip straight through them. Nissan 370Z?
Yeah, great car. Great car. I mean, again, forget the image. But for the money, you know, I think they're good looking. Lovely 3.7 strong V6 engine. Lovely gearbox. Proper balanced 2-seater. Traditional hairy chested sports car. Love it.
At 10 grand, I mean, you more or less have your pick of MX5s, don't you? There'd be tons out there.
10 grand's far too much money to spend on an MX5. I kind of went about this thinking 10 grand or less. You could pick up a nice MX for a perfectly serviceable MX5 for, you know, a quarter of that money. I don't want to dwell on the MX-5 because I think everybody knows what great cars they are. But, I mean, I would get a Mark 1, frankly. I would get the best Mark 1 that your money can provide, because I think that they are the nicest of them. I think they're the nicest to look at, and I think they're the nicest to drive. And I think that they have a certain sort of original authenticity about them, which later cars don't.
I did an auto solo in a very, very cheap Mark 1. I think the guy had only spent 800 quid on it or something. And also solos where you'd skid about around some cones on a disused airfield or something. And it was huge fun. It was fantastic. Okay, let's keep going. Did you ever get along with the Alfa Romeo Brera, the V6 one?
No.
Okay. You could have one for 6 grand, but you shouldn't.
Yeah, yes, unless you're considering a Brera Spider, which says you should definitely get the coupe. To me... A car which just is all I don't want an Alfa to be, because although it looks amazing and it's got that fabulous engine in it, it's kind of like, you know, getting some really lovely ingredients for a meal together, cooking it, and it's still tasting rubbish. And, you know, you'd almost rather have had beans on toast, because it would have been a lot less effort and would have tasted nicer. So, you know, I love that engine, but no, because the chassis just wasn't right on it, and it was heavy and ponderous and blah. No, sorry.
Okay, what about one of its predecessors, the GTV?
Yeah, better. Definitely better.
Very pretty car.
Very pretty car. Twin spark or V6, probably a twin spark, just better balanced. They also, you know, they had they were on the same platform as the Fiat Coupe, but they had, you know, they had different rear suspension, and Alfa tried quite hard with those GTVs. I suspect that you would probably be running into bodywork issues with those these days, but if you can find a nice one, cool looking car, not a great to drive, you know, compared to, you know, whatever Porsche would have been up against at the time, you know, 944, 968, whatever. No, not in that league. But, you know, they're a really nice car, so much better than a Brera.
Now, this whole podcast, we've dressed it up as, you know, a 10 grand sort of theoretical car buying exercise. But actually, Andrew, it's just been one very long advert for a car that you have for sale.
I've forgotten all about it. Yes. Get it while it's hot. Yeah. Well, there you go. Yes. Some of you may be wondering why a 205 GTI hasn't figured on this list yet. So I'm not going to dwell on it, because I do not want to hijack my own podcast as a form of free advertising. But yeah, I have one. Some of you may know of it. It's been in various magazines for a while, it will be up for sale on the Collecting Cars website in the next week or two. And obviously, it's going to go for massively more than £10,000, because it's such a wonderful car, and it has such an utterly heroic owner.
He said,
but. You can get a really nice 205 GTI for 10 grand. And having owned one for the last 8 years and only selling it because I was looking through the MOTs, it's MOT time, and I was looking through old certificates, and I just saw how shockingly, appallingly little I was using the thing. And I've just, yeah, I've basically just disgraced myself into selling it because it's, you know, I'd just rather somebody else was enjoying it, frankly. But if you are in a position to get out there and enjoy such a thing, I mean, you know, everything anybody ever says about those cars, as long as you get a good one, and good ones are hard to find. Thing about those cars is they don't rot. You know, you think 80s French hats, you'd think they'd all fallen to bits by now. They're actually, they're quite resistant to that sort of thing. So what that actually means is it's not difficult to tart one up. It's not difficult to make one look an awful lot nicer than it really is. So, you know, you, I mean, I looked at, in my mind's eye, I kind of think I looked at dozens. I probably didn't. I probably only looked at 10. But, you know, the previous nine were all, you know, nicely presented wrecks. And, but if you can find a good one, they are the greatest fast hatchback that's ever been built. And I think having driven certainly most, if not all of them, you know, there's nothing I've driven which would persuade me to modify that view. So, yeah. Even if you don't buy mine, if you like the idea of that sort of thing, and I think, and again, I sound like I'm advertising my own car. I really am not. I still think that, you know, although they have appreciated in recent years, I suspect that they've got further to go. I'd also, if you can, try and get one without a sunroof. Mine's got one because I couldn't find one without a sunroof. And yeah, they're fine with, but certainly as an investment, non-sunroof cars, non-sunroof 1.9 pre-cat car. Is the one to go for, but you know, unless it's done a load of miles, you're going to struggle to find one of those for 10 grand these days.
Well, there we go. We've had hot hatches, we've had coupes, we've had roadsters, we've had super saloons, we've had a couple of V12s in there. I think that's quite compelling, isn't it? The sort of breadth of stuff that you can pick up for £10,000 is brilliant. I mean,
as long as you don't want a mid-engine supercar, they're really. You know, there's not a genre, I don't think, that 10 grand won't take you to. There's not a kind of car, an example of which you couldn't buy if you had, you know, 10 grand in your pocket and, you know, you'd taken some brave pills that morning. And I think that's, you know, I think that's great.
Well, fantastic. There we go. Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for listening. Please remember to leave a comment, a little review for this podcast. That really does help. Subscribe as well. Tell your friends. Tweet about it. Post about it on Instagram. That would all be helpful. And if you do want to bung us a little bit of money each month, and in return you'll get some exclusive written content from Andrew and me, head over to patreon.com/drivenation. We'd be enormously grateful. And keep listening. We'll talk to you all again next week. And Andrew, thank you very much.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Dan, really, that's been a fun hour. I hope it was half as entertaining to listen to as it was to talk about. So thank you one and all. We'll catch up with you next week.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up Quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's Quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.